Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of April 12th through 19th. And I'm joined this week by Scott Korb, the author of Life in Year One, What the World Was Like in First Century Palestine. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Tim. Nice to be here.
Well, Scott, we really appreciate you coming by our offices to talk about your book. This is Easter week, so we thought this was a good opportunity to talk about the research you've done and the analysis you've done of this kind of slice of history. Maybe we can begin by talking about one of the points you lay out right away in the book, which is even though you're writing about Jesus's time, this is not necessarily a book about Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way that I open the book, that the introduction is titled, in fact, this is not a book about Jesus. Embarking on this book, which really is an attempt to do exactly what you said, which is to give this little slice of history, really about 75 years from about 5 BCE to 70 CE. In embarking on my research on that piece of history, I found so often that the people who were writing about that, the scholars who were spending their time in that, you know, specific years, are really specifically interested in Jesus, and in fact pinning down who Jesus was. So you get people saying, well, from my research, I want to say that Jesus is God. And from my research, I want to say that Jesus was a typical Jew. And those are questions that this book didn't really want to get into, because those questions are often very contentious. And that's not to say that there's no room for that kind of research and that kind of writing. But if we want to start talking about the world around Jesus, I didn't want to get mired down, bogged down in all that big conversation.
Now, when you started your research here, I mean, obviously the Gospels, that's a primary account of the period, but what other historical accounts are available to you, as you said, about your research?
Well, let me say this. They're very limited. The Gospels are a resource, but certainly, as with any first century document, as with any piece of historical writing, the Gospels want to tell a very particular story, and they want to tell a very particular story about a very particular, specific, very special man. And going beyond the Gospels was, for me and my work, essential. Unfortunately, there's so little from that time period that remains that, you know, my options are really limited. So I basically had, from the first century, some bits of the Talmud, which I relied on here and there, so the earliest rabbinic writings. But then primarily I used, whom all the scholars use for this time period, Josephus, who was a Jewish historian who throughout that time ended up becoming a part of the Roman military. So he was a Jewish historian who basically switched sides toward the end of the century, as it seemed like, well, Judaism was going to take a very brutal hit, which it did. That's sort of how the book, that's the trajectory of the book, is the fall of Judaism in the first century, ultimately resulting in the destruction of the temple. But Josephus's history, called the War of it's called the Jewish War, that is really the primary source. So it's Josephus, that work, as well as another work he did called The Antiquities of the Jews. And then there's one other Roman historian named Tacitus who I rely on very occasionally.
Now, let's look at some of the figures that you encounter in your book, one of which is Herod. But as you were explaining to me earlier, there's some clarification needed here in terms of our understanding of who Herod was. In fact, there was a father and son.
Yeah, exactly right. So Herod the Great is, for a Christian audience, he's the Jewish king that we know from the Gospels as, well, the one who committed the slaughter of the innocents. So we know him from the Christmas story. Now, he died before year one. He died in about 5 BCE, which is right around the time when Jesus was born. And his son, who was also named Herod, although his name was Herod Antipas, he was granted the land of the Galilee, basically as his to rule, because he, you know, was the son of the great king. Now, King Herod the Great was known primarily for being, well, on the one hand, extremely brutal, and on the other for being an architectural genius. So he had the architectural vision to reconstruct the temple in Jerusalem, which by all accounts is the grandest structure, you know, that city, that Jerusalem had ever known. And then again, as I said just a few minutes ago, then by 70 CE in the Common Era, that was totally destroyed and leveled by Rome. And what we're left with is just the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall. And Herod Antipas he's known in the Gospels as the Herod who killed or who had John the Baptist killed. And so when Jesus is referring to a Herod, or when Jesus is referring to who he calls that snake in the Gospels, he's not referring to Herod the Great, who's been dead for, 25 years by that point, or 30 years. He's referring to his son Herod Antipas.
Well, that's helpful then. The slaughter of the innocents, that's King Herod. The killing of John the Baptist, that's his son.
Right,
so that's
exactly,
the key distinction there.
Right, right.
Well, you mentioned Rome, and as you write in your book, I mean, you could not escape, you can't talk about this era without talking about Rome and the influence it had over a part of the world that was, fairly removed from Rome and from Italy, yet, or what was to become Italy. How did they do that? How did the Roman powers exercise that kind of influence so far away?
They did it through local authorities. So Herod, as much as he was Jewish, and as much as he was the Jewish king, was given all of his power by Rome. So we have Mark Antony, the kingmaker, this Roman figure whom we know through Shakespeare and beyond. It was Mark Antony and the Roman Senate who actually granted King Herod all of his authority. And so you have a man whose power essentially comes from the empire, but whose people are very, very, very religious, loyal Jews. And so Herod was sort of in a way stuck in the middle, knowing that his power came from this foreign place, but the people he ruled were Jews. So they exercised power, especially over a place like Jerusalem, through basically making the king, giving him the power from Rome. And then outward from there, in the outlying city, so a place like Sepphoris, that was the capital of the Galilee. And again, so you had the ruler, who was Jewish, whose power was granted by Rome, ruling over a major city, in the outlying areas. So this is north of Jerusalem. And in order to support the growth of this major city, which really was Herod Antipas's ambition, so he was granted the Galilee, and he really wanted to have a capital for himself. So he sets up this major city, and then from there, in order to support that major city, they have to begin to grow out into the hinterlands and start farming that land, because if you have a growing city, you're going to have a growing population, and so you're going to need more and more and more and more food. So from the major city, you have these outlying cities, Nazareth may have been one, where the farmland was basically usurped by the ruling parties, and the people who lived on that land became essentially tenant farmers.
So that gives us a good picture, too, of what people were engaged in, what work they were engaged in. Sounds like it's largely agricultural.
Right, right. Agriculture would have dominated any of the inland areas. So Nazareth, again, it's not on – Nazareth has essentially no water source except a small trickle called – well, it's now called the Well of Mary. So they would have been engaged in small farming before the growth of these major cities in the Galilee. And then after, they would have become – parts of larger estates that the same people would have farmed, but they no longer would have owned that land. A place like Capernaum, though, which is out on the water on the Sea of Galilee, they would have been, as makes sense, they would have been engaged not in farming as much, but much more in fishing. And so we find, Jesus out in Capernaum engaged with people who were, fishermen, basically.
Now, one point you made in your book, which I thought was interesting, was kind of the not quite rivalries, but between north and south, between Galilee and Judea. Here are two parts of, maybe in the Christian's mind, they've kind of been conflated, but there are some real differences between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a much more urban feel in the south, in Jerusalem especially. So this is a major city. And with it being a major city, you have the same kind of mixing of different cultures that you would have in a major city today. It becomes a crossroads. And with that comes a kind of sophistication and a kind of worldliness. As we often hear about the major cities in our country today, there may also have come with that a kind of pretension and a kind of arrogance over the people who came from the farmland, the hinterlands. And on the other hand, if you imagine someone living in the Galilee. So you have a tenant farmer, a peasant farmer living in the Galilee, who's, you know, a very, very dedicated Jew, whose capital is Jerusalem, although he may never have been to Jerusalem. So in his imagination, you have the seat of God. This is where God lives, in Jerusalem, you know, in the temple. That's the Holy of Holies. And so you can imagine that person developing a very romantic view of what Jerusalem might have been like. And so in part of the research for the book, I look at this Catholic scholar named J.D. Crossan, John Dominic Crossan, whose his scholarship is mainly about finding the historical Jesus. And he, in thinking about Jesus on the way down to Jerusalem for Passover, basically in this time of year, he imagines Jesus as, you know, coming from Galilee, having these really, really romantic notions about what Jerusalem was supposed to be like. So when he arrives at the temple and he sees that there's money changing going on and he sees that there's all these animals wandering around the temple, well, not within the temple walls, but certainly they would have, you know, this is where the sacrifices would have, you know, sure, been kept. And so Crossan imagines that you have Jesus with this very romantic idea arriving in Jerusalem and just being his whole romantic notion being turned on its head. And so this frustrates, annoys, however you want to say, this frustrates Jesus, and so he gets angry, and this is where he turns the tables over. So it was there was this, again, this romantic notion that then turned into this, you know, what most people consider the most violent moment of Jesus's life, this moment where he's turning over the tables and he's angry and he's you know, casting people out of his father's house. But that would have been everyday life in Jerusalem. That's what Jerusalem looked like. And, you know, for us today, I think we often have romantic notions of the Holy Land. So for those people who haven't been to Jerusalem or who haven't been to Bethlehem, say, we have these romantic notions of what that part of the world is like. And when you arrive in Jerusalem, it's a bustling, magnetic mess. You know, that's one of the phrases I use in the book. And it's filled with tourists, and it's filled with inconvenience, and it's equally filled with these sacred places. And having to sort that out is a problem that, you know, pilgrims today have to face as much as pilgrims back in the first century would have had to face. Is how do you really negotiate with your imagination what your imagination says these holy places should be and what the reality, you know, ends up being? I was talking with an archaeologist in Jerusalem when I was there in March last year, right around this time last year. He talked about how Jews who go to Jerusalem, so this is not just a Christian or a Catholic romantic notion, that Jews who arrive in Jerusalem for the first time have that same kind of experience where they expect something far more sacred and far less profane. And when you get there, you realize it's just a combination. And sussing that out that's the age-old question. That's what Jesus had to do. That's what we have to do.
Now, your book, just to give readers a sense, our listeners, you know, you talk about money in year one, home in year one, food in year one. Can't address all of them now. We've talked about a couple of them. But one I thought would be worth talking about before we end, which is the baths in year one. I mean, it just people forget that, you know, it was very hard to keep clean when you're engaged in work, you know, whether it's agriculture or working as fishermen. These are, you know, and you were wearing sandals. So this emphasis on purity was very important. Maybe you could talk about that.
Right. Well, when we're talking about baths in year one, which is, again, one of the chapter titles, we have to talk about basically two different kinds of cleanliness. So we have a kind of cleanliness that's all about, you know, making sure your hair is clean and your face is clean and you don't stink too much. And that becomes really, really difficult when, again, Tim, as you're saying, you know, we're doing mainly agricultural work. Your houses are basically dirt floor. The roofs are hay or straw, or your walls are coated in mud or dung. You know, I mean, this is a dirty place. And yet there was some attention. You know, we have to imagine that these people living back then cared to a certain extent how they looked and how they smelled. And so baths were important and cleanliness was important just the way we think of it today. The more important kind of purity, the more important kind of cleanliness would have been, as you say, ritual purity. And throughout the Galilee, throughout Judea, what archaeologists have found are first century baths, which we know today as, and they would have known then as mikveh baths. Mikvaoth is the way that's the plural. And those were filled with mainly with rainwater. It had to be living water. And that was a regular means of purifying yourself. And so as much as a first century Jew would have cared about keeping themselves sort of, again, as I said, base level clean, much more they would have concerned themselves with keeping themselves ritually pure. And, you know, that marker of Judaism, that marker of Jewish identity, is all, you find it all throughout the Galilee, all throughout Judea, these baths. And that's one of the really interesting things that I was able to, well, that I learned in writing this book. Scholars who write about the first century, archaeologists, biblical scholars, first century historians, they're all very hesitant to say anything for sure. You know, and so they use these two words, imagine and perhaps. Those are key words that they use over and over and over. And those end up being words that I have to use over and over and over. And and for me, as a writer, it's as much about my imagination as it is about the reader's imagination. I mean, I rely on the reader to do a lot of the work in this book, you know, because I can't give you anything for sure. Well, I should rephrase that. There's only four things I can give you for sure. And those four things are all about Jewish identity. Archaeologists have found no pig bones from the first century. They've found all kinds of ritual baths. They've found no coins with any faces on them, which meant that this was an aniconic society, so that this was a society who did not have any icons anywhere. And finally, when they were eating and drinking and preparing food, they used stoneware, which is to say they did not use ceramics and they did not use glass. They used bowls and mixing vessels vessels for wine and vessels for olive oil that were taken directly from the ground. And this meant for them that they were using the holy land. I mean, they were actually literally using that. And so those four things are the four things that scholars say that they can know for sure. And it's important to note that all of those things are markers of Jewish identity.
Right, and as you write, that religion was permeated every aspect of the culture there.
Right, right, right. You can't talk about economy, you can't talk about our agriculture, you can't talk about baths, you know, you can't even talk about keeping yourself clean without talking about God.
In many ways, you know, this world seems very foreign to us. You know, we're 2 millennia removed. You know, people live in very poor conditions. Yet, as you write, what you're trying to do here, or at least one of the things you're exploring, is how there isn't as much difference between us and them as perhaps we would imagine. To use that word that you mentioned, maybe you could talk more about that.
One thing that I would really like a reader to take away from this book is I explore sort of the ins and outs of life in the first century, is just to say that the concerns of the people, concerns with everyday things like cleanliness, with food, with worrying about money, you know, all of those things, those everyday, those trivial things that those people had to deal with, those are the same things, of course, that we have to deal with. Just like the concerns with sacredness, the concerns with religion, the concerns with what does God, you know, what would God have us do? All of those things are also the major concerns of the people of the day. You know, what happens when we die? You know, those big questions are the same kinds of questions. So just on the level of ideas, I want people to take, I would like to, you know, people to take that away. The other thing that I emphasize in this book, really just by placing a focus, is I really want readers to imagine, there's that word again. I would really like readers to imagine the lives of in this case, some of the poorest of the poor, those people who, you know, had to build their houses out of dust, whose soap was made out of dust. And if we can imagine people living in those conditions 2,000 years ago, if this book can in any way help us imagine what it was like to live in poverty way back then, that same kind of imagination is the kind of imagination that I think we all ought to try to employ when just thinking about the people in our own time. You know, there were poor people back then. There are poor, poor, poor people today living somewhere in the world with a dirt floor and a dirt roof and dirt walls. And, you know, I want to emphasize that I try to have a lot of fun in the book. And, you know, it's very easy to make fun of things when you're writing about dirt and baths and building walls out of, you know, dung. So as much as I want to have some fun in the book, I also hope with this book as well, and that has everything to do with what I was just talking about, that it's not just the sort of playful imagination that it takes to imagine, you know, what these houses look like or what these fields look like or what the temple would have looked like. There's also something like a moral imagination that it takes. And as much as I, again, as much as I wanted to have some fun and to be playful and to talk about imagination in that way, I really like to think of this book as one that might ask something of the moral imagination as well.
And this connects to my final question, which has to do as, you know, you're Catholic. What drew you to this subject? You know, what were sort of the, you know, who were some of the people that inspired you in writing it? You know, what were kind of the guiding principles that that helped you complete this project?
A couple of the scholars who I've mentioned, well, one of the scholars I mentioned was a Catholic scholar, John Dominic Crossan. And his research into the first century helped me a great deal. And another scholar whose research into first century sits at a fundamental, sort of a fundamental to this book, is Gary Wills, whose translations of the New Testament, you know, he hasn't done full translations, but in his books, what the Gospels meant and what Jesus meant and what Paul meant, he does all of his own translations of the New Testament. And when I read those books in the years up before I was even thinking about writing this book, he made the New Testament alive for me again in ways that if you go to church every week and you read, you know, the New Revised Standard Version or however you're reading the Bible, or if you go and you back and you read the King James, everything sounds so pious and sanitized when you read those things that it can sort of wash over you a little bit. And I think there was a time of my life when the New Testament was washing over me. Gary Wills translates the Greek. Greek is the original language of the New Testament. He translates it in such a way that it sounds as rustic and as pigeon and as slapdash as it probably actually was in that time. So here's a translator who's trying to give you a feel in his books for how the language really would have sounded. And so I actually asked a Greek scholar I know to do translations from this New Testament Greek, which is lowest common denominator Greek. It's not at all classical. It's called Koine. I asked him to do translations that were inspired in part by Gary Wills. And so I wanted to get that same feeling of lowest common denominator, pidgin Greek. And, you know, I was talking before about the moral imagination and giving us an opportunity to think about the poorest of the poor. And Dorothy Day she appears nowhere in the book, but she is one of my very favorite writers, period. Absolutely one of my very favorite Catholic writers. And her work among the poor and her writing about the poor stands behind every word I write about the poor. I mean, there's no question about that. And I can mention one other Catholic writer who stands behind this book or who inspired me. And, you know, we talked before about how this is not meant to be a book about Jesus. But, you know, there's a cutout of Jesus on the cover of the book. So there's no getting around the fact that somewhere Jesus is here. And Flannery O'Connor famously talked about Hazel Mote's in her book, Wise Blood, that somewhere in Hazel Mote's, as he was coming up with this church without Christ, somewhere in the back of his mind was Jesus flitting around from tree to tree to tree. And that same thing happens in this book. I mean, not only does Jesus appear in the words, you know, that begin every chapter, there's those translations I was talking about that preface every chapter, but as much as this is not a book that speculates about who Jesus was, there's no question that he's somewhere in every chapter poking his head out, you know, making himself known. Maybe that's the best I can do with Jesus, is let him make himself known. You know, I don't speculate on who he is. The word miracle comes up in the book, and I say, well, you know, I'm on a little shaky ground when it comes to talking about miracles. But, you know, I took some real comfort in Flannery O'Connor's words that as much as we try to put Jesus at the background, when you're writing about his time, he's going to pop up. He's going to flip back and forth from tree to tree in the back of your mind. And he certainly did that in my mind, and I think certainly does that in this book.
Well, that's, I think, a good message to end with on this Easter week, and we want to thank Scott Corr for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Happy Easter.
I want to thank you for joining us for the American Magazine podcast and wish you a happy Easter. We'll be on a two-week break, but there's some items online you might want to look at, including a Lent and Easter meditation on the art of James Tissot from editorial director Karen Sue Smith.
We also have a review online of the Irish film The Eclipse, which was directed by the playwright Connor McPherson. To respond to our podcast, you can do that at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.